What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. On today's show, W. Kamau Bell.
We can have a conversation about brutal things, things that make us sad, and find laughter, because that's your system's self-defense mechanism to not get taken down by the pain, right? And also, as Black folks, if we didn't turn this pain into art, we wouldn't still be here. If we didn't figure out ways to find some breath and some space, we wouldn't still be here. You know, America, you're welcome for all of your popular music because Black people are like, I got to do something with this racism. How about invent rock and roll?
From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I am so excited about our guest today, comedian, television host, political pundit, advocate, husband, daddy, and I get to call him my friend. We are joined this morning by the one and only W. Kamau Bell. He's got a new book out, Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book. What's up, my G?
Hey, how's it going? Good to talk to you.
It's going great. How are you doing?
You know how it's going out in these streets.
It's another day as a Black man in America.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a book that is a 101 approach
to racism, which means automatically white people are one of the biggest audiences.
More time to chat today than we ever have before, so I want to start with a little bit about you.
I'm tired of explaining racism to white people.
You were born in Palo Alto, California, but kind of
shouldn't have to do it anymore. Send them the link to buy this book.
What was that like, and how did it shape your view of the world?
It's not about the fact that I learned most of my life traveling this country, but
if you could only give it from a very young age, I would. My mom lived in Indianapolis, and then I would go to Alabama to visit my dad, and then we moved to Boston, and we moved to Chicago. So I have just spent, at a very early age, I learned that not every corner of America was like every other corner of America. And every corner of America judged people in other corners of America, and often they weren't correct about how they were judging them.
But you were Black wherever you went. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Did you experience your Blackness, you know, differently in Boston than perhaps Chicago?
I mean, I'd really say the difference at that point in my life was North and South. That's how I experienced the difference. Was like, you know, that there was a very different way in which I felt walking around the streets of Chicago and Boston. And I was, you know, I was young, this was before I turned 13, versus how I felt walking around Alabama. And weirdly, you know, there's that expression in the North, they don't care how close you get as long as you don't get too high. In the South, or the North, they don't care how high you get as long as you don't get too close. In the South, they don't care how close you get as long as you don't get too high. So Southern racism can be very friendly. it can be very inviting because they're sort of used to everybody being together. Whereas in the North, it's friendly on the surface, but it doesn't go that deep.
You know, people look at me like I'm nutty when I say it, but I sort of prefer the racism in the South. I know
it's more clear. The lines are clear.
Yeah, it's more clear. Exactly. Like, I can navigate that, right? More so than I can sort of navigate, you know, neoliberal trash, right? Where someone is saying one thing, but then their actions, clearly they don't like me or my kind.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things I think I've done for my daughters is that, you know, this has changed during the pandemic significantly, but they've been going to Alabama their whole lives to see their grandpa. So they, like me, they're not going to develop a fear of the South just because it is the South. They will know, well, no, that part is cool. I wouldn't go there. They will actually know that there's different Souths in the South, which I think is important. And I didn't realize how important it was when I was growing up until I got older and really moved out here to the Bay Area and would be like, yeah, I'm going to go visit my dad in Alabama for vacation. They're like, for vacation? In Alabama? And I realized people, you know, even in the liberal bubble of Berkeley and Oakland, that people are afraid of the South.
Yeah, I was afraid of the South for a little bit. I actually would be a black belt had the competition not been in Texas. And I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I was like, yeah, I'm cool. Yeah.
But then it's funny because Las Vegas, when you get off the strip, is basically the South.
Yes. Exactly. Man, most people don't know that. They don't realize that Vegas is still very segregated racist town founded by the Mormons, the mob, and cowboys. So,
yeah, you know, exactly. What kind of shot. That's what I was going to say. It's like a mobster cowboy town.
Exactly. Kamau Bell, when did you figure out you were funny? Like, when did jokes enter the scene?
I mean, I know. I mean, you know, I was going to say, I think I'm still figuring it out, but I was a kid. I didn't figure out I was funny. I figured out I loved comedy first. So, you know, I'm of that age where I remember when Eddie Murphy came on Saturday Night Live, and it was like, you know, I remember when Eddie Murphy came on. I'm like, he better be funny as Garrett Morris. Like, that's the age I am. Like, so, like, I remember.
Right. Yeah.
You know. Too. Yeah. So I was, there's a thing now called a comedy nerd, and I realized, oh, I was a comedy nerd before that was a thing. So it was a thing I really enjoyed. As an only child, I was always in my head, so I was always thinking of things and cracking myself up and making my mom laugh and then making my friends laugh. But I wasn't the class clown. It really was just something that I really felt like I wanted to do and felt like I could do, but I was not a kid who was like, you know, my dad still laughs when he remembers me telling him that I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, because he was like, you've never said anything funny in your life. I was like, not to you. I'm afraid of you.
Yeah, right. I read somewhere that you were described as a socio-political comedian. Mm-hmm. How did you get politicized, and what were some of the first issues that you were passionate about?
I mean, I'll say this. I grew up around, like, just sort of, one of my best friends, Jason, like, his after-school job was with an organization called Sane Freeze, which was about nuclear disarmament. So he was 16, knocking on people's doors, talking about nuclear disarmament. And that just meant that, like, from a very early age, I had political people around me. You know what I mean? Like, people who were, like, where they were always, the conversation were going ways that I was, like, not expecting or prepared for, but always knew that there was a bigger world than mine. I was thinking, living in that generation where, like, the before the Berlin Wall and after the Berlin Wall, like, there was that also that generation of, like, there was some big changes. I mean, I'm also hiding under desks in case a nuclear war happens.
Like, do you laugh about that these days? Because I do. Because, yes. You know, Nevada, test site. Like, those were the drills. Like,
yeah, hide under
so
your
we're gonna
desk.
So we're going to fry to death under the desk?
Mostly because they just was like, we don't know what we would do. So at least if you're under the desk, we know where all the kids are. So we can tell them they're all under their desks once the nuclear war happens. But so I mean, I think that sometimes I think are more overtly and more mainstream political than others. I was as a kid, I understood that Ronald Reagan was bad. I didn't know why, but I knew all the adults were mad at him in my life. So I think, and my mom, I don't think I understood it as political at the time, but she's, of that generation where anytime a group of black folks got together, I mean, it still happens now, but really, like, this is post-civil rights era. Black people kind of think maybe we can achieve our way out of this, but then also realize very quickly that they can't. So I had a joke in my act back in the day that I was 11 years old before I realized that a cracker was also a delicious snack. There was always talk. And I think that, so for me, it was just like, and then I think, but really what politicized my act and my routine was Barack Obama running for president, was when it was like everywhere I heard they were talking about this black man. And it just felt me like so much mainstream media was racist in the way they talked about it, even if they were saying it, talking about him in quote unquote good ways. And that's when I was like, I'm thinking about this all the time. I want to put it into my act.
And certainly, of course, it's a huge, huge deal, right? First black president of this country. And sometimes I think about the impact of his presidency on black people. And what I mean by that is, I remember, so the night that he was elected the first time, I remember I was sitting in what used to be a black bar in downtown Oakland. Those don't exist anymore, but that's not the show. And it was just full of black people, right? And there was this moment where the returns started coming in, and it was so clear. It was just it. Mm-hmm. Like, Obama was going to be the next president of this country. And the black folks started singing, "Free at last, free at last, almighty, free at last."
Yep.
And I looked at my partner at the time, and I said, "We are so beeped." Because I was just so clear that we had put all of our faith into this dude. Who had not said anything about being our salvation. I mean, to his credit, right? He never made the promise and then broke it. He never made the promise.
He allowed people to put the promise on him, right? Like he understood that part of his ascension was that people saw him as the promise, and he never said, no, 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 no. Like he never said that. He was like, yeah, I'll let you do that because I understand that part of this brand. And even the hope and change thing was sort of vague enough that you could put hope and you could put it into any box you wanted to.
Yeah. And then he was a president, right? For for good, for bad. I mean, I certainly have critiques of his presidency. But I think that that impacted Black people in a kind of way. And I think we saw that the second round that he ran. And that downward trend of Black folks having any desire to engage with this system, Democrat or Republican, ever since.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, for me, you know, I was certainly somebody who was probably, you would have looked at, I was probably singing Free at Last in that bar, wherever I was that night, just because the symbol did feel like something, and it did feel impossible. And I remember I was with my mom, who, you know, grew up in Indiana. And so the idea that there would be a Black president in her lifetime was, you know, not, she couldn't wrap her brain around it at first. And so there is a part of it, like, this is a big symbol, it means something. But then, you know, our mutual friend Fabiana Rodriguez and Jeff Chang, our mutual friends, took me to the border and talked about Obama as the deporter in chief. And this was like, you know, within a couple years of that. And so I really started to understand that, like, as you said, he's presidenting the way presidents president. And because he is this symbol, he doesn't get, maybe we're not even looking at him as a Black community as honestly as we look at another president, because we're sort of overtaken by the symbol.
And we're seeing that, right, that immigration issue again with Biden, where, like, folks were so excited and ready to be done with the orange dude, right? Mm-hmm. And there were all these promises that Biden made about, you know, undoing so much of the damage that Trump did or continued, right, to do to immigrants. And Biden, here we go, with another Democratic president just dragging his feet. You know, a lot of folks are talking about, right, Republican, Democrat, what does my partner say, two sides of the same bad penny. I think that's how the phrase goes.
Michael Moore used to say the evil of two lessers.
There you go. Exactly. And there's this conversation about a third party. I mean, we have the Green Party, but I don't find that they're engaging the folks they need to engage, i.e. Black folks, brown folks, poor folks, in the way that's necessary to mobilize folks. And I'm looking at this upcoming, you know, the next presidential, where that dude has said he's running again. And I'm gravely concerned about the ability of the left to mobilize.
I'm here to talk to you about the Forward Party, Andrew Yang's party. I really, just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
I mean, I'll listen. You're the homie. I will listen. I might have something to say afterwards, but I'll listen.
I love you. Okay. All right. Come out. Try me.
You might get lots of emails, but go for it, my dude.
No. I'm totally kidding. I am not. That is not. No, I think, yes, the idea of another party is exciting, but as I learned, even when looking into, me and Hari Kondabolu looked into the Green Party a lot when Jill Stein was running, which I know that's a four-letter word. But like the idea, and actually Rosa Clemente is the one who sort of really explained it to us in a way that was like, oh, that you need so much infrastructure and so much money. And really, if you're going to be a third party candidate, you should be running for like for local office before you, and build your way up to something like the presidency. And that takes a long time, and people don't want to think about that. So they just want to run for president, you know? So, so yes, I get excited no matter what but when I see candidates winning local offices or smaller offices who are clearly not the business as usual, I was a white guy lawyer who went to law school, you know, who went to an Ivy League academy. So for me, people who are just, who are outside of what the system normally promotes, I get excited when I see those people winning office. And you're seeing more and more of that around the country. People who never would have thought about running for office 20 years ago are now thinking about, are now running and winning local elections or smaller elections.
Yeah, I mean, I'm yes, me too. And
I'm watching. Yes, not putting my hope in electoral politics to save us, I think, is the other
thing.
There
we go.
From someone like you. I'm just saying, the thing I take with me from Boston is the idea of the poo-poo platter. I don't know, do you know what a poo-poo platter is? A lot of people in the West Coast.
What's the poo-poo platter?
A poo-poo platter is a thing that happens at a lot of Chinese restaurants, especially the ones that, like, non-Chinese people go to, where it's like, it's just an appetizer platter, but it's just basically like, instead of like, do you want the egg rolls or the spare ribs or the wontons, it's a platter filled with all those things. Like, so it's called a poo-poo platter. When I was a kid, it was my favorite thing to get. And so I feel the same way about rescuing America from the clutches of fascism. Let's try everything. Let's just do a little
all
bit.
All roads in. I'm there with you. All roads in, right? We need the streets for sure. And we do. We need people that are brave enough to sit in the belly of the beast. And I've seen, though, how it eats up progressives.
Yeah, no,
and how hard that is, right?
For sure.
And we elect people, and then we just leave them there. We're like, all right, well, she's got it, or he's got it, and then we disappear. And then we're like, well, how come no change happened? Well, because we stopped happening,
I mean, I look all at right, jobs, Mal. Like, you think, like, people get, like, you see all the people running for, like, I mean, we're going to do that here shortly, but I think about mayor of New York seems like an awful job. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems like, it just seems like, and yet a lot of people want that job. And the minute they get it, New York City's like, no, not you. And
listen, I ran for mayor and I'm so glad I lost. I'm so glad I lost. Yeah. Can I tell you?
I mean, I didn't want to put you on Front Street like that, but that's exactly the same thing. Like, thinking of you as mayor of Oakland does not seem like, I mean, I don't know if this is, but it doesn't seem like a great job. It doesn't seem like a great job.
It looks like a horrible job. I mean, I ran hard, y'all that supported. Thank you so much. You included. Thank you so much. Yes. And I just, you know, hindsight or perspective, you know, almost 4 years out, I'm like, whew, dodge that bullet.
And yet you want somebody to have that job who is a person that you like and feel like wants to do good and has good intentions and has good people behind them. So you want a good person to have it. But ultimately, once they get it, it's not like it's, you know, it seems like a bad job.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You all are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We're in conversation with Kamau W. Bell. You have a new book out, Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book. What was the impetus for the book? How did it come about?
Well, yeah, first of all, it was co-written by Kate Schatz, who's another local, Alameda residence, and she's written the books Rad American Women A to Z, which she collaborated with Miriam Kleinstahl, who's a head of the art department at Berkeley High School still, I believe. So it's a home game all the way through. So me and Kate, it was really like, you know, 2020, COVID's happening, and, you know, the news is all about COVID. And then, as we all know, George Floyd got murdered by the police in Minneapolis on May 25th. And then suddenly me, and I'm sure this happened to you too, suddenly you get all sorts of people reaching out to you, all sorts of white people reached out to you, all sorts of white media outlets basically saying, can you please show up and explain racism? And you're like, hasn't that been my job for the last 10, 20 years, whatever? And I found myself having the same conversations with a bunch of different, like, I got booked on more white talk shows. I guess those are just called talk shows mostly, than I had in my life. Like, people just come on this show and talk to us, come on this show and talk to us. And so I started reaching out to Kate because Kate was doing the same thing from her white perspective because she's an anti-racist. And I was like, can you tell me new things to say to these white people, especially these white people with privilege? And so we had a lot of conversations about it. And one of those conversations that we had ended up being the framework for a conversation I had with Conan O'Brien. That was like, I felt like this is the best conversation I've had like this because Kate had helped me. And so then I was like, maybe we can write a book together. And we started talking about that. And we both had the idea of, like, instead of writing one of there's many great anti-racist books out there. Many of them feel like textbooks or don't feel like, we're like, how do we do this in a way that is like, how do we make the revolution irresistible, as the saying goes? So we're like, let's try to make it fun, but not screwing around, as we say. I'm cleaning it up for the radio. Like, so let's actually like fill it with like activists and ideas and assignments and ways to do anti-racism work in your community and games and puzzles and crossword puzzles. But it's gonna be fun, but it's really gonna have like some hardcore information in there. And that's what we've tried to do with the book.
And it does have hardcore information in there. I mean, I learned stuff. I consider myself a student of the movement and history. I think one of my favorites is you have, there's this page in there about presidents and the top hits of presidents or something.
The greatest
hits. The greatest hits, there you go, right? And then you have to assign the horrific thing that president did with their
Which
face.
President did the horrific thing? And, you know, and let me be clear, I just want to say this, Kat. We were thinking about, like, you and Alicia Garza and all these activists we know in our lives, that, like, what if Kat Brooks picks this up and is like, what is this, bull? Like, you know, it's like... Like, we wanted to make sure that our friends who are in this life every day, even if you're like, yeah, I don't need to know all this because I've been doing this work all my life. Oh, but there's things in here I didn't know. And I appreciate the fact that they actually are doing the damn thing.
I do. I mean, I did have a question in here with you for you. It was like, okay, dude, crossword puzzles and coloring and stickers, which some of these are going on my computer, by the way. I have a new computer and it needs to be populated with stickers. Sure. I was like, this isn't funny. But of course, you found a way to make it funny and enjoyable. You know, there's that phrase, laugh or scream.
Mm-hmm.
And I try really hard to laugh because screaming hurts my throat.
Yep. And you want to save the scream for when you need it.
Go ahead. Exactly. Talk about using comedy to help people digest stuff, right? So for that person that maybe doesn't want to hear me scream FTP on the corner or long speeches about all of the horrible things, how comedy helps folks digest some of the stuff that we got to sit with.
I mean, I would say this, like, you know this, Kat, because I've hung around with you long enough. Like, we can have a conversation about brutal things or things that make us sad and find laughter, because that's your system self-defense mechanism to not get taken down by the pain, right? So every funeral, there's somebody laughing at some point. And also as black folks, if we didn't turn this pain into art, we wouldn't still be here. If we didn't figure out ways to find some breath and some space, we wouldn't still be here. You know, America, you're welcome for all of your popular music, because black people were like, I got to do something with this racism. How about invent rock and roll? And so the idea being that, like, that I don't, people ask me all the time, like, how do you turn it into humor? I just don't understand. Like, I'm almost like, I don't even understand the question, but I think professionally, I'm just doing what we all do as amateurs, is like, we take this pain and we figure out a way to find laughter in it. And also, the best way to communicate anything is through laughter. Like, every public speaker tries to be a little bit funny. They all try to open on a joke, because you know if people are laughing, they're paying attention. That's the only response you know that people are actually doing, because they are paying attention. People can go, mm-hmm, and be thinking about laundry. People can go, yes, amen, and be thinking about laundry. But if they are really laughing, if they're actually not pretending to laugh and really laughing, then you know they're paying attention.
You say in the book, white folks probably need the book most, but it's not explicitly for white people. Say more about that.
I mean, I just think we you know, when you start to, I mean, I know this from the work I do all throughout life, like with United Shades. I know that the core audience of United Shades is your average CNN viewer who does not look like me or you. So therefore, I've learned over time, like, there's ways to communicate information where you sort of where you tell the audience who you're talking to when you're talking to them. So, like, we did an episode about black folks in Appalachia. So if you watch that episode, there's times where I'm talking to black folks about us, and these are our people. The white audience, I'm not talking to them, but they can sit and listen to it and learn something. But then there's times where I'm talking to that white CNN audience. I might even go, and you white people out there, blah, 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 to let them know this part is for you. And so for me, I think when you put any project together, you sort of want to know who the audience is, especially with a book. And then I think with a book like this, I know there's going to be people who suspiciously pick it up, who are like, who's this book for? All right, I see you picking it up that way, so we're going to put it in here at the front, so you can go, it is definitely a book that is a sort of a 101 approach to racism, which means automatically it's white people are one of the biggest audiences. I had a black woman get mad, not mad, but she was like, I'm tired of having to explain racism to white people. I'm tired of it. And I was like, well, that's what the book is for. You shouldn't have to do it anymore. Send them the link to buy this book. And because I get that. I do get that. So, yeah, it's not about the fact that, like you said, you learned something there. I learned stuff putting the book together. But who needs the 101 racism conversations country more than anybody? If you could only give it to one group of people, it would be white people.
Right. You say you learned something, too. What is the thing that you learned that stands out the most as you were putting this book together?
I mean, Kate is really the history buff. So, like, there's so much history in this book that, like, I was, like, completely ignorant to, or sort of thought I understood but didn't understand. So there's, like, so I think that, for example, like, there's there's the page where we have the different photos that are sort of look like a museum gallery. And you have to look at the photos and say what you think is going on in those photos. So that's an example of, like, I don't think I would have known. Man, not all of them, but many of those photos, I wouldn't know what was going on. And then once you find out what was going on, your stomach drops usually, you know. And I think that's a great example of, like, how do you take information instead of just putting a photo in a book and going, this photo is this? How do you take people on a journey to go, oh, this is a photo with white people laughing. Oh, they must have just finished a picnic or something. They're so this is the photo where these white people found out they're not guilty for murdering Emmett Till. And they're smiling and laughing about it. And so for me, it's like that's the all the history. Like, I'm one of those people who did not like history in school because the way I think now I look back, because the way it was presented to me. And yet now I'm the person who's like, we'll click on any YouTube video that's like, let me explain this thing in 5 minutes. Okay, let's go.
Come on, there's all of these places now, right, in this iteration of our movement for white folks to talk about race in a quote-unquote safe space. And I do want to shout out organizations like Surge, or locally we've got CRC, Community Ready Corps, I think it's Accomplices and Allies. from your perch, right, traveling all over the world, talking to a bunch of different kinds of white people, including the Ku Klux Klan. I know that was a long time ago, but I just, every time I think of you, I think about that episode. I'm just like, Stu is out of his mind. But anyway, I watched it just to see if you died at the end.
People still think I might die at the end, even though it was like 8 years ago.
What have you found are the greatest challenges? And you do cover some of this in the book, you and Kate. For white folks, what have you found, like, are the challenges that make it so hard for them, right? Like, some folks get, like, mad if you even bring up the word race and racism. And I'm not talking about, like, the far, far right, Trumpite.
Mm-hmm. No. You're talking about...
Those folks. I'm talking about just, you know, your average, you know,
you're talking Mary about Berkeley Jane. Residents. and
yeah,
residents.
Exactly. What have you found?
So we talk about this in the book. I think one of the biggest obstacles that people, that those types of white people who want to be on the right side of history and want to help, is one, the sort of the paralysis of analysis. Like, they're like, it's such a big problem, I don't know what to do, so maybe I'll just do nothing, is the first thing, because they don't know how to get in. So the book is designed to go, here's a variety. There's probably hundreds of ways you can get in throughout this book, as far as like things you can do in your neighborhood, in your town, that you can help. And, you know, that, and some ways that you don't even understand that, like, oh, why would helping a mutual aid organization be part of anti-racism? Because generally mutual aid organizations are trying to help black folks and people of color. So I would say this. So that's one, is like, we give you a lot of ideas. And the other thing is like, but what if I mess up is the thing that keeps people from doing the work. A lot of white folks, what if I mess up? What do I? And we sort of go, no. It's not what if you mess up. It's what do you do when you mess up? And sort of embracing the fact that you're going to mess up at some point, and then how do you recover? And so we really concentrate on the idea of, like, don't get so afraid that you're going to mess up that you don't do anything. Just understand that at some point you're going to mess up. And then it becomes about recovering, which is about apology and amends and doing better.
Yeah, and I clocked that page in here too, like how to apologize when you mess up. You also say in the book, right, that, so this covers, you know, a lot of history, also, you know, things that are happening here in the present, but you say towards the end that this book is about the future. What do you want folks to do after they read this book?
I mean, for me, this is like, I mean, I did a lot of martial arts in high school, and so I owned a lot of martial arts books. And at some point you understand, reading the book on martial arts does not make you an expert in that brand of martial arts. Like,
out the hard way.
Yeah, exactly. You get this. I just finished reading a book about martial arts, so I'm ready to fight. That the book is sort of saying, this is how you begin a practice of this martial art. And also, if you practice it by yourself, you're probably not going to get that good at it. The books always show you partner activities. And so the idea being that, like, reading the book is not the work. Reading the book is like the way to start, is one way to start the work. And so the hope is that you start, that people who read this book, who come to this with like that sort of like, I don't know what to do and I'm afraid I mess up, by the end, we're really encouraging you to put a plan together. And as we all know with working out, whatever our workout is for us, some people it's like The Rock. I follow him on Instagram. He's working out twice a day, every day. And for some people, it's like, I'm going to walk around the block once a day. But we all know that if you don't do it regularly, you're not going to get the benefits of that working out. And it's the same, as you know, preaching to the choir with anti-racism. If you're not regularly engaged in it, then you're not going to get the benefit. So, and also, if you're not raising the stakes of what your personal best is, you're going to stop getting the benefit of it. So if it's the same walk your entire life around the block, that it's not going to mean as much to your body. And so I think that's what we want to get that's people right. know, that like, this is about putting action out there and doing it regularly and starting wherever you start, but building on it.
Yeah, and I mean, I say this a lot, and actually shout out to my friend Maureen Benson, who does a lot of white anti-racist work, and who I heard say it first, right? Like, being an accomplice or being an anti-racist, working on it, it's every day. It's every single day, no matter how far you've come, how much you've overcome. And I think that's true actually for all of us, right? So I say, you know, white supremacy is a disease and we are all infected, right? So even black folks, like every single day, I gotta get up and I gotta look at the way in which white supremacy is showing up in my behavior, my language, the food I buy, you know, where does even my privilege show up?
For sure. Yeah. And I feel that same way. That's why when people ask me, even when you're at the beginning, it's like, how are you doing?
I could go into a long litany of things that I feel like are wrong right now. Again, I recognize I'm living at a very high level of privilege based on the career I have and the success in the career I've had. So I've just resorted to saying, as I'm like, I'm doing better than many. You know what I mean? So don't get caught up in my own problems, especially when I'm talking to somebody and on the radio about the problems I have, because compared to what most folks are going through in this country, specifically if we're talking about the people who live in the Bay Area and black folks in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco that it's hard out there right now, and it's getting harder out there right now. So I want to understand my level of privilege at all times.
I want to get into some of the issues now, Kamau. You had me and Deputy Director of APTP James Birch and our friend Professor Nikki Jones. Hey Nikki, she usually listens at UC.
She's in the book.
I know she's in the book. This is very exciting. Last year, 2 years ago, I don't know.
It's hard to know, but it was last year. It's 100 years ago. It was last year.
Yeah. That's what it feels like. To talk about defund, right? Like, you sort of were on this mission to help people understand defund. And since that time, we've seen what I believe is a coordinated national misinformation campaign. Like, I really want a reporter to do a FOIA request, because I think something came out of the White House and every city across the country that was trying to beat back the defund momentum operated from whatever that was, right? Like, tell these lies. And the lie, part of the lie was this rise in violent crime that we've seen in urban cities, and here in Oakland, and was defund's fault, even though defund didn't happen anywhere. So it didn't happen,
right? But it somehow ruined everything.
It ruined everything. I believe that it came as a result of the economic pandemic, right? That
of course.
Was hot on the heels of the coronavirus. How has that impacted the way you talk about defund? Are you still trying to help people understand what that means, or have you thrown up your hands and
I'm not in the position to throw up my hands. I only throw up my hands if you call me and go, come out, stop talking about defund, we're throwing up our hands. I'd be like, all right, Cat Brooks, tell me to stop talking about it. But other than I'm
not doing
always,
that. We said 50% and we mean it.
Other than that, I'm always on a, first of all, I want to be clear. Reach out to me if there's something you need me to do, please, as always, let me know. I think recently I was tweeting about something. I was like, this is why we talk about defund the police. So there was, there's all these, all these examples throughout the media regularly of black folks who people are calling the cops on them for mental health disturbances, and they end up dead. Like, so many examples of that, which to me is like the most basic reason to defund the police. And then everything we're seeing in the COVID era, and all the economic disruption and all the wage problems are all things are like, these are more arguments for defund the police. And it's just about, and I know that that phrase, as has become, it's like woke. It doesn't mean anything of what it originally meant, or critical race theory. The right has a good job of taking phrases that come out of the left and turning them into something that nobody on the left would recognize, and then selling them back to the left. And then those same white people we were talking about earlier, who are like, I want to help. But then they buy into the right's version of that phrase, not the left's version of that phrase.
Right. I mean, I think one thing that you do have the power to do, I do think we need to be having conversations about abolition, yes, and defund, and also right now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, our people are hurting right now, right? Like, I think Oakland is about to surpass 80 homicides this year. And having those conversations, but I feel like we shy away from on the left, right? We don't want to talk about the right now. We don't want to talk about the fact that people are getting killed, but we have to, because those are the folks that we have to help understand that we've been investing in this system of policing forever. And it has never kept us safe, and it's not going to keep us safe. But helping folks find the courage to say, F the status quo, we got to do something different. But we got to have the conversation.
I 100% agree. And like I said, I feel like my role in that often is like I did with the Defund the Police episode of United Shades, is to bring on people like you who are ready to, who know how to have the conversation. And my job is just to, I'm the DJ, you're the rapper. I'm just there. Chief Armstrong, who was on that episode of Defund the Police before he was a chief, talking about things that he was going to do and ideas. And he was sitting there with Pastor Michael McBride and his brother Ben McBride. Mm-hmm. And there was this sort of sense of that what would happen, and now, of course, what would happen once he became there, or at that point, I think he was headed towards being the chief, but he was not announced yet. But the idea, and I've seen him on the news all the time looking like, I don't know what to do here. So it's clearly something's got to change.
Listen, he went on Fox News, and you don't have to say anything. I don't want to paint you in a corner, but he went on Fox News and told all the white people that his department had been defunded after he got a $38 million increase. So, and then he don't understand why I talk. He said to somebody, he was like, well, she keeps talking bad about me. Yeah. What do you want me to say about you? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, come on, my G.
I mean, I also
supposed to, in theory, want the same thing.
Some jobs getting talked bad about is a part of the job. I have a job like that. Like, so I can't.
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's part of the job description is people are going to talk bad about you. And that's why the benefits are so good for a job like chief of police, which I know they are better than they are for your job, Kat. I'm not trying to say you two are the same.
We are definitely not the same. Actually, I was going to ask you that, but then I skipped over it, but I'm going to go back. Part of the job is being talked bad about. You know, I get death threats, hate mail, dragged on, you know, Twitter, which y'all is not real life, but you know, I get dragged there. What about you? Backlash, threats?
Oh yeah.
About your safety? You've got a family?
Yep. I mean, all that. I mean, I certainly worry about it. I certainly think about it. And, you know, and we have, like, made changes in our lives to make sure that we feel more safe. So, you know, which I'll just say that, you know, so it's certainly something that I think about all the time. You know, there's we have security people on United Shade. So, that you know, there's just a lot of things that we have done to sort of because, yeah, I got young kids. And the other thing is, like, the most backlash I probably maybe have ever experienced over a sustained period of time was after the Cosby doc came out earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a lot of that backlash was from us, from our people, from black folks.
I had a question for you about that. So I'm like skip down on my little list of questions. Let's segue to that. Yeah. I do want to spend some time talking about United Shades. It took me a minute to watch it, but I did. Like moment of truth here, right? I was scared to watch it. The whole conversation was so hard.
Yeah, I understand.
All the outrage, of course, right? Right? And like, I didn't have. I love my daddy. My daddy was doing other things when I was growing up. That did not always include being a daddy, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the family. Like when we as little black kids, right? Mm-hmm. That was the family we wanted. That was the daddy we wanted. You know, without the rapey stuff, of course. Why did you decide that we needed to talk about it? And what was it in was part of the mission? And I'm making this very much about me. Excuse me, but to give some of us permission to have the conversation, was that part of it?
I think for people, it's really the heart of this discussion is people like, you know, I was born into the Cosby world, as I would say it. Like he was already everywhere on TV. He was all over kids' TV. He was on grown-up TV. And then by the time he starts doing the Cosby Show, I was like served up. I was 11 years old in 84. So I was perfectly primed for that. And so for me, it's about like, and then I became a stand-up comedian and it's like, well, how do I talk about his influence on my life now? Knowing what I know and believing all these women. So, and for me, it was like, I can't throw the positive influence away. And I don't want to not confront the negative things because I don't want to be the person who's like the white people we just talked about who are like, I don't know what to do. So I'm not going to do anything. And for me, there was really like a way of like, if me and you were to sit down at that old black bar in Oakland and we would just be like, let's talk about Cosby. I think it would be a pretty wide open conversation. And so I was and maybe if there was a bunch of our friends there and we had some other cool people there who we didn't know, but this person's an expert on drugs, this person's an expert on the sexual issues, that it would be a pretty wide open conversation that would uncover lots of things. And we would all sort of weigh in where we felt like we could fit in, but it would definitely be centered on a black conversation. I felt like I wanted to try to have that conversation that I feel like I've seen happen or been a part of, but in a broader way that invited more people into the conversation.
Yeah, and I had that question too written down to talk to you about. Was it our people that came for you? You know, black folks, we say often, and I think this really like has been passed down like from the days of chattel slavery, right? Where our business being out in the open could mean that we were killed or our children were killed you know, any of the other horrible things that happened to us. But there's definitely that tenet in our community. Like we keep our business to ourselves. We don't air our dirty laundry in front of the white folks. What was the tone and tenor of the black folks that came for you after that documentary?
I think there's sort of, I would say, two distinct groups. One group of people who don't believe Bill Cosby did anything wrong and is being targeted by. Yeah, okay, exactly. So that I don't really have much time for that conversation. Like, I just don't.
We're past that.
Yeah, I don't have any time for that conversation. So, but they, so it's just like people who just like, he didn't do anything wrong. Or the, or this is how show business works and he's no different than everybody else who does this. And you're like, but what about the hypocrisy? And they don't have time for that. So, and then there's the people who are like, I don't care what he did wrong. We don't do this. We don't have this conversation. Again, you're saying like, we don't tear down a black man. And it's been pointed out to me by many people, he tore himself down. And anything, this doc does a lot to sort of go, now that it's all torn down, let's see what's here. And so there are a lot of things in that doc that I think a lot of people learned about Cosby in that doc in ways they wouldn't have learned if we hadn't talked about all of it. So yeah. Like the stuntman stuff and like the HBCU things or things that like a lot of people who were not as privy to the conversations me and you are had never heard about before. I mean, I know stunt performers who'd never heard, like, you know, that had never heard about the black stunt thing, which is an important story. It's just a complicated story because of everything else he was doing.
Yeah. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We are in conversation with Kamau W. Bell, who co-wrote a book with Kate Schatz called Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book. Kamau Bell, 7 seasons of United Shades of America. You're still here. Yep. Are you surprised you've lasted this long? I mean, not only are you a black man in Hollywood, but you're a black man with a big mouth in Hollywood.
And it gets bigger every season.
Standing. Are you surprised you're here? And how do you balance surviving in Hollywood with like not being afraid to say all the things?
I mean, luckily, I think the thing that has been the 7 season that has maybe been the biggest blessing for me, which is funny to say, is that I'm not in like regular Hollywood. I'm on this news channel, CNN. So the metric for success is probably different. Like they don't have a million shows on air. They have like over a course of a year, they have less than 10 shows. And I would say, like, as far as original series, they maybe have 4 different original series. So, like, once I got in and showed I could do what I needed to do, it sort of was like they were like, keep that guy going. So, like, I just think that, like, if I was on NBC at 8 o'clock on Thursdays, to go back, the metric would be different. So I think that, like, I benefit from the fact that there are more outlets and more ways to judge success. And so one of the things that I think that has actually worked out is just because of the fact that we've won some of the shiny trophies, it sort of shows that the industry respects what we're doing. So I think that has helped. But no, I didn't. I just always, you know, I didn't know that I would. I always joke and say, I think I'm in the Showbiz Hall of Fame just to be 7 seasons of a television show at this point in history is a big deal.
For real.
And also at the same time, the other thing I've never done is like rested on that and just sort of like, okay, well, I got that. I won't do anything else. So like you're talking about the Cosby doc. We talk about the book. I always realized that this moment could pass at any moment. And I don't want to be sitting here like going, oops, but I thought I was going to be on TV forever. So I'm always trying to figure out ways to get more work out there and do more things. So yeah, but I definitely feel lucky, blessed, highly favored that we've made some people. And also like I know that the landscape I came into was very different than it is now. My show followed Bourdain's show, and it was meant to sort of be like a show that, like, if you like this, you might like this. This year I followed Patagonia, which is like a nature documentary, so the landscape has changed dramatically.
Yeah. You talked about this earlier, and I want to talk about it some more. You did a segment on Black Appalachia, which I'm super excited about. A couple things in that episode. You talked to my friend Ashley Henderson about the Highlander Center.
She's great.
I love her so much. She's phenomenal, right? She's one of my sheroes. A lot of folks don't know about the amazing history of that place, right? Like, legit, where Rosa Parks and MLK trained, and the fact that it's still going and supporting organizers and activists. Talk about learning about the Highlander Center and your conversation with Ms. Henderson.
Well, this is interesting because I think, like, it's a history that I was not really privy to either. We did a show about coal miners in Appalachia, like, in season 2, I think, and we stumbled across these black coal miners there. And so ever since and that was not a part of what the show was supposed to be, but basically one of my producers, Geraldine Porras, who also produced the Cosby Doc, like saw this thing called the Lynch Colored School. It was like, I think Kamau's going to know more about this building. So she went in to talk to the people and they ended up being on the show, which was great. And so we sort of went back to that same place and did a deeper dive, but really was like the impetus behind it was our producer, Mo Fallon, who you know from the Defund the Police episode, who has family in West Virginia. So he was the one who was like, we need to go back and tell the stories of Black Appalachia. Like he was Mo's like a bro, but like the best, sweetest, biggest, hardest white bro you'd ever meet. Like really, really gets it and is doing the work. And so he was the one who was like, we need to go back and tell these stories. And then for me, it was like one of those episodes where it's like, I just get to sort of go along for the ride and learn and have a good time and try to shoot a squirrel and then, you know, and go to a baby shower and like really, and then go to the Highlander Center, which you feel like with Nikki Giovanni and make pig's feet with Nikki Giovanni, you know, like, so that was really one of those where it's like, it wasn't my like idea. So I just got to ride side saddle to this great experience that Mo had put together and then sit at the Highlander Center and just feel like that's one of those moments of making TV where you're like, who cares that we're filming this? I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah. I had the privilege, it hasn't aired yet, so I might get in trouble for talking about it, but I got to talk to Imani Perry, and she's got a new book out called South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. And she's from the South, but she starts the book by talking about needing to go to the Appalachia to talk to Black folks there and her trepidation about going to a place with such a history of extreme violence, right? Extreme racism. Like we mentioned, you know, you kick it with the Klan, so maybe you were cool, but did you have any trepidation about going to that part of the country?
I mean, I guess at this point, I know this is a part of what I do, so there's definitely your top eye is a little more open, as that old poster would say in Boston, like, you know, because you're going to places where it's like, you know, all those weird Brandon signs, you see them everywhere. Yeah. And it's not that I care about that, but it just sort of lets you know, this is the kind of people who live here. You know, you certainly know that, like, there's a lot more like open, like sort of like just weird, like sort of anti-Democrats, not anti-democracy, but anti-Democrat signs in like store, like this is a candy shop. You know what I mean? Like, what are we, you know?
Right.
And so, but it doesn't feel, again, I think that like, but then you meet these Black folks who are like, I love it here. I would never leave. I hope to not have to leave, despite the fact that industry has left and real estate is hard to find or there's not resources around here. There's not a grocery store. This is my home. And so when you look in the face of those Black people who are like, who, yes, I see all those signs or yes, there are people around here, but this is my home and I love it here. It sort of helps you look at it through a different lens.
I just looked at the clock. I have so many more things I want to talk to you about, but I'm running out of time. Okay, all right, you better. You have to. Like you mentioned, you have so many like pans in the fryer. Right? I look up, there's another thing that you're doing. What's on the horizon for you? What's coming up next? I mean, I know you're on the book tour. Is that going well?
Yeah, no, it's good. We are our last stop of this leg of the book tour is actually at City Arts and Lectures in San Francisco. That's in September. Okay. So in that giant theater in San Francisco. So please come check us out there. Me and Kate will be there with Anna Sale, who's also a Bay Area resident from Death, Sex, and Money. And then we're also, me and Kate are working on like a kid version of the book that will be very different, but an anti-racism book for kids. So those are the big projects I'm working on now. And there's just you know, that's the thing. There's a lot of things that have happened right now, but nothing that is like in a position to sort of go, it's here. So, but I'll let you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be on the lookout for that. Kamau W. Bell, thank you so much. I know that you were in the middle of all of the things and you took an hour out to chat with me.
Hey, no, you ain't got to thank me for that. What am I going to do? Tell you, what am I going to do? Tell you no? What, I had no home training? I don't owe you? What are you talking about, Kat? Come on.
Right on, my brother. You have a great day. You talk too. Soon. Right. We have been speaking to renowned comedian W. Kamau Bell, who is the co-author of Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book that he wrote with co-author Kate Schatz. He's also the host of CNN's United Shades of America, the writer and producer of We Need to Talk About Cosby, a miniseries that explores the impact of the life and career of Bill Cosby up to and including his sexual assault cases. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about our topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis. That's D-I-S. And subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.